and I went in and rescued of him. Mr. Peggotty burst into a great roar of laughter, and Agnes and I both kept him company. But I must say this for the good creature, he resumed, wiping his face when we were quite exhausted. She's been all she said she'd be to us, and more. She's the willingest, the truest, the honestest helping woman Master Davy has ever drawn the breath of life. I've never known her to be lone and lorn for a single minute, not even when the colony was all afore us and we was new to it. And thinking of the old one is a thing she never done, I do assure you, since she left England. Now, last, not least, Mr. Micawber, said I. He's paid off every obligation he incurred here. Even to Traddles' bill, you remember, my dear Agnes. And therefore we may take it for granted that he's doing well, but what is the latest news of him? Mr. Peggotty, with a smile, put his hand in his breast pocket and produced a flat-folded paper parcel, from which he took out, with much care, a little odd-looking newspaper. "You're to understand, Master Davy," said he, "as we've left the bush now, being so well-to-do, and have gone right away round to Port Middlebay Harbour, where there's what we call a town." "Mr. Micawber was in the bush near you," said I. "Bless you, yes," said Mr. Peggotty, "and turned to with a will. I never wish to meet a better gentleman for turning to with a will. I've seen that there bald head of his perspiring in the sun, Master Davy, till I almost thought he would have melted away, and now he's a magistrate." "A magistrate, eh?" said I. Mr. Peggotty pointed to a certain paragraph in the newspaper, where I read aloud as follows from the Port Middlebay Times. "The public dinner to our distinguished fellow colonist and townsman Wilkins Micawber, Esquire, Port Middlebay District Magistrate, came off yesterday in the large room of the hotel, which was crowded to suffocation. It is estimated that not fewer than 47 persons must have been accommodated with dinner at one time, exclusive of the company in the passage and on the stairs. The beauty, fashion, and exclusiveness of Port Middlebay flocked to honour to one so deservedly esteemed, so highly talented, and so widely popular. Dr. Mell, of Colonial Salem House Grammar School, Port Middlebay, presided, and on his right sat the distinguished guest. After the removal of the cloth and the singing of Non Nobis, beautifully executed, and in which we were at no loss to distinguish the bell-like notes of that gifted amateur, Wilkins Micawber, Esquire, Jr., the usual loyal and patriotic toasts were severally given and rapturously received. Dr. Mell, in a speech replete with feeling, then proposed our distinguished guest the ornament of our town. May he never leave us but to better himself, and may his success among us be such as to render his bettering himself impossible. The cheering with which the toast was received defies description. Again and again it rose and fell like the waves of ocean. At length all was hushed, and Wilkins Micawber, Esquire, presented himself to return thanks. Far be it from us, in the present comparatively imperfect state of the resources of our establishment, to endeavour to follow our distinguished townsman through the smoothly flowing periods of his polished and highly ornate address. Suffice it to observe that it was a masterpiece of eloquence, and that those passages in which he more particularly traced his own successful career to its source, and warned the younger portion of his auditory from the shoals of ever incurring pecuniary liabilities which they were unable to liquidate, brought a tear into the manliest eye present. The remaining toasts were Dr. Mell, Mrs. Micawber, who gracefully bowed her acknowledgments from the side door, where a galaxy of beauty was elevated on chairs at once to witness and adorn the gratifying scene, Mrs. Ridger Beggs, late Miss Micawber, Mrs. Mell, Wilkins Micawber, Esquire, Jr., who convulsed the assembly by humorously remarking that he found himself unable to return thanks in a speech, but would do so with their permission in a song, Mrs. Micawber's family, well known, it is needless to remark, in the mother country, etc., etc., etc. At the conclusion of the proceedings, the tables were cleared as if by art magic for dancing. Among the votaries of Terpsichore, who disported themselves until Sol gave warning for departure, Wilkins Micawber, Esquire, Jr., and the lovely and accomplished Miss Helena, fourth daughter of Dr. Mell, were particularly remarked. I was looking back to the name of Dr. Mell, pleased to have discovered in these happier circumstances Mr. Mell, formerly poor, pinched usher to my Middlesex magistrate, when Mr. Peggotty, pointing to another part of the paper, my eyes rested on my own name, and I read thus: To David Copperfield, Esquire, the eminent author. My dear sir, years have elapsed since I had an opportunity of ocularly perusing the lineaments now familiar to the imaginations of a considerable portion of the civilized world. But, my dear sir, though estranged by the force of circumstances over which I have had no control from the personal society of the friend and companion of my youth, I have not been unmindful of his soaring flight, nor have I been debarred, though seas between us braid her roared, Burns, from participating in the intellectual feasts he has spread before us. I cannot therefore allow of the departure from this place of an individual whom we mutually respect and esteem without, my dear sir, taking this public opportunity of thanking you on my own behalf, and I may undertake to add on that of the whole of the inhabitants of Port Middlebay, for the gratification of which you are the ministering agent. Go on, my dear sir. You are not unknown here, you are not unappreciated. Though remote, we are neither unfriended, melancholy, nor, I may add, slow. Go on, my dear sir, in your eagle course. The inhabitants of Port Middlebay may at least aspire to watch it with delight, with entertainment, with instruction. Among the eyes elevated towards you from this portion of the globe will ever be found, while it has light and life, the eye appertaining to Wilkins Micawber, Magistrate. I found, on glancing at the remaining contents of the newspaper, that Mr. Micawber was a diligent and esteemed correspondent of that journal. There was another letter from him in the same paper, touching a bridge. There was an advertisement of a collection of similar letters by him to be shortly republished in a neat volume with considerable additions. And, unless I'm very much mistaken, the leading article was his also. We talked much of Mr. Micawber on many other evenings while Mr. Peggotty remained with us. He lived with us during the whole term of his stay, which I think was something less than a month, and his sister and my aunt came to London to see him. Agnes and I parted from him aboard ship when he sailed, and we shall never part from him more on earth. But before he left, he went with me to Yarmouth to see a little tablet I had put up in the churchyard to the memory of Ham. While I was copying the plain inscription for him at his request, I saw him stoop and gather a tuft of grass from the grave, and a little earth. "For Emily," he said, as he put it in his breast. "I promise, Master Davy." Chapter 64. A Last Retrospect. And now my written story ends. I look back once more, for the last time, before I close these leaves. I see myself, with Agnes at my side, journeying along the road of life. I see our children and our friends around us, and I hear the roar of many voices not indifferent to me as I travel on. What faces are the most distinct to me in the fleeting crowd? Lo, these, all turning to me as I ask my thoughts the question. Here is my aunt, in stronger spectacles, an old woman of 80 years or more, but upright yet, and a steady walker of 6 miles at a stretch in winter weather. Always with her, here comes Peggotty, my good old nurse, likewise in spectacles, accustomed to do needlework at night very close to the lamp, but never sitting down to it without a bit of wax candle, a yard measure in a little house, and a workbox with a picture of St. Paul's upon the lid. The cheeks and arms of Peggotty, so hard and red in my childish days when I wondered why the birds didn't peck her in preference to apples, are shrivelled now, and her eyes, that used to darken their whole neighbourhood in her face, are fainter, though they glitter still. But her rough forefinger, which I once associated with a pocket nutmeg grater, is just the same. And when I see my least child catching at it as it totters from my aunt to her, I think of our little parlour at home when I could scarcely walk. My aunt's old disappointment is set right now. She's godmother to a real, living Betsy Trotwood. And Dora, the next in order, says she spoils her. There's something bulky in Peggotty's pocket. It's nothing smaller than the crocodile book, which is in rather a dilapidated condition by this time, with divers of the leaves torn and stitched across, but which Peggotty exhibits to the children as a precious relic. I find it very curious to see my own infant face looking up at me from the crocodile stories, and to be reminded by it of my old acquaintance Brooks of Sheffield. Among my boys this summer holiday time I see an old man making giant kites and gazing at them in the air with a delight for which there are no words. He greets me rapturously and whispers with many nods and winks, "Trotwood, you will be glad to hear that I shall finish the memorial when I have nothing else to do, and that your aunt's the most extraordinary woman in the world, sir." Who is this bent lady, supporting herself by a stick, and showing me a countenance in which there are some traces of old pride and beauty, feebly contending with a querulous, imbecile, fretful wandering of the mind? She's in a garden, and near her stands a sharp, dark, withered woman with a white scar on her lip. Let me hear what they say. "Rosa, I have forgotten this gentleman's name." Rosa bends over her and calls to her, "Mr. Copperfield." "I am glad to see you, sir. I am sorry to observe you are in mourning. I hope time will be good to you." Her impatient attendant scolds her, tells her I'm not in mourning, bids her look again, tries to rouse her. "You have seen my son, sir?" says the elder lady. "Are you reconciled?" Looking fixedly at me, she puts a hand to her forehead and moans. Suddenly she cries in a terrible voice, "Rosa, come to me! He is dead!" Rosa, kneeling at her feet by turns, caresses her and quarrels with her, now fiercely telling her, "I loved him better than you ever did," now soothing her to sleep on her breast like a sick child. Thus I leave them. Thus I always find them. Thus they wear their time away from year to year. What ship comes sailing home from India? And what English lady is this, married to a growling old Scotch Croesus with great flaps of ears? Could this be Julia Mills? Indeed it is Julia Mills, peevish and fine, with a black man to carry cards and letters to her on a golden salver, and a copper-coloured woman in linen with a bright handkerchief round her head to serve her tiffin in her dressing-room. But Julia keeps no diary in these days, never sings affection's dirge, eternally quarrels with the old Scotch Croesus, who is a sort of yellow bear with a tanned hide. Julia is steeped in money to the throat, and talks and thinks of nothing else. I liked her better in the desert of Sahara. Or perhaps This is the desert of Sahara. For though Julia has a stately house and mighty company and sumptuous dinners every day, I see no green growth near her. Nothing that can ever come to fruit or flower. What Julia calls society, I see. Among it, Mr. Jack Maldon, from his patent place, sneering at the hand that gave it to him, and speaking to me of the doctor as so charmingly antique. But when society is the name for such hollow gentlemen and ladies, Julia, and when its breeding is professed indifference to everything that can advance or can retard mankind, I think we must have lost ourselves in that same desert of Sahara, and had better find the way out. And lo, the doctor, always our good friend, labouring at his dictionary, somewhere about the letter D, and happy in his home and wife. Also the old soldier, on a considerably reduced footing, and by no means so influential as in days of yore. Working at his chambers in the temple, with a busy aspect and his hair, where he's not bald, made more rebellious than ever by the constant friction of his lawyer's wig, I come in a later time upon my dear old travels. His table is covered with thick piles of papers, and I say as I look around me, if Sophie were your clerk now, Traddles, she would have enough to do. You may say that, my dear Copperfield, but those were capital days too in Holborn Court, were they not? When she told you you'd be a judge. But it wasn't the town talk then. At all events, says Traddles, if I ever am one, why, you know you will be. Well, my dear Copperfield, when I'm one, I shall tell the story as I said I would. We walk away arm in arm. I'm going to have a family dinner with Traddles. It's Sophie's birthday, and on our road Traddles discourses to me of the good fortune he's enjoyed. I really have been able, my dear Copperfield, to do all that I had most at heart. There's the Reverend Horace promoted to that living at £450 a year. There are our two boys receiving the very best education and distinguishing themselves as steady scholars and good fellows. There are three of the girls married very comfortably. There are three more living with us. There are three more keeping house for the Reverend Horace since Mrs. Crewler's decease, and all of them happy. Except, I suggest. Except the beauty, says Traddles, yes. It was very unfortunate that she should marry such a vagabond. But there was a certain dash and glare about him that caught her. However, now we've got her safe at our house and got rid of him, we must cheer her up again. Traddles' house is one of the very houses, or it easily may have been, which he and Sophie used to parcel out in their evening walks. It's a large house, but Traddles keeps his papers in his dressing room and his boots with his papers, and he and Sophie squeeze themselves into upper rooms, reserving the best bedrooms for the beauty and the girls. There's no room to spare in the house, for more of the girls are here, and always are here by some accident or other, than I know how to count. Here, when we go in, is a crowd of them running down to the door and handing Traddles about to be kissed until he's out of breath. Here, established in perpetuity, is the poor beauty, a widow with a little girl. Here, at dinner on Sophie's birthday, are the three married girls with their three husbands, and one of the husband's brothers, and another husband's cousin, and another husband's sister, who appears to me to be engaged to the cousin. Traddles, exactly the same simple, unaffected fellow as he ever was, sits at the foot of the large table like a patriarch, and Sophie beams upon him from the head across a cheerful space that is certainly not glittering with Britannia metal. And now, as I close my task, subduing my desire to linger yet, these faces fade away. But one face, shining on me like a heavenly light by which I see all other objects, is above them and beyond them all, and that remains. I turn my head and see it in its beautiful serenity beside me. My lamp burns low, and I've written far into the night. But the dear presence, without which I were nothing, bears me company. Oh, Agnes. Oh, my soul. So may thy face be by me when I close my life, indeed. So may I, when realities are melting from me like the shadows which I now dismiss, still find thee near me, pointing upward. The End.